Imagine doing everything perfectly right. You're hypervigilant. You are watching your child like a hawk right in your own living room.
Yeah, you feel totally in control.
Right. But statistically, there is a 74% chance that if they go missing, the incident begins right in that moment under your direct supervision.
It's a completely terrifying thought.
It really is. So welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring a document that, honestly, it just shatters how we think about what makes a home safe.
Absolutely shatters it.
We're looking at the Autism Safety Plan for Home, which is a parent's guide published by AngelSense back in June of 2026.
Right, and it's such a crucial piece of literature.
And I want to be super clear with you listening right now. Even if neurodivergence isn't a part of your daily life, the mission of this deep dive is to look at how environmental design, psychology, and technology all intersect to create genuine safety.
Yeah, it really fundamentally changes how you view the physical spaces you live in.
Exactly. So what is the core philosophy here? Because it feels really different from standard childproofing.
Well, the overarching idea in this guide moves us completely away from reactive panic. I mean, a typical safety plan is essentially just a list of things to do when a disaster is already happening.
Like who to call when things are already on fire.
Exactly. But this document proposes a massive paradigm shift. It says you need to build predictability and structure into the environment itself.
So it's not about, like, hovering over them 24/7.
No, not at all. You aren't trying to wrap a child in bubble wrap, you know. You're trying to empower their independence by designing a world that actually speaks their neurological language.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the baseline statistics the source lays out are just, they're intense.
They really are.
It says autistic children are 2 to 3 times more likely to get injured than other children. And I think our instinct is to just, I don't know, buy more of those little plastic covers for the electrical outlets and call it a day.
Right. The classic baby-proofing aisle at the hardware store.
Yeah, exactly. But reading this, that feels like treating child-proofing like a blunt instrument.
That's a great way to put it. A blunt instrument assumes every single brain perceives risk the exact same way. And the elevated injury rate here, it isn't an issue of clumsiness.
What is it then?
It really comes down to danger awareness and executive functioning. For many autistic individuals, the brain's ability to foresee the sequential consequences of an action just isn't processing in the typical way.
Sequential consequences. So, like, meaning if I pull this cord, a heavy object will fall on my head.
Precisely. That if A, then B, logic isn't always front and center. And then you add to that the tendency for intense hyperfixation.
Oh, right, where an object just becomes the absolute center of their universe, blotting out literally everything else in the room.
Yeah, the cognitive tunnel vision is absolute. So if a child is fascinated by, say, the spinning blades of a fan, they aren't noticing the wobbly base. They aren't seeing the frayed wire.
They just see the movement.
Exactly. And that intense focus naturally leads to tampering. And the tampering is what escalates to an injury.
Wow. And the source also dives heavily into this concept of panic mode. Specifically how sensory processing turns standard emergencies into something so much more complex.
Yeah. Sensory processing dictates the entire emergency response. Think about a child with hypersensitivity.
So everything is turned all the way up.
Right. Their sensory inputs are cranked to maximum. If an accident happens, like a glass breaks in the kitchen, the sharp sound, the visual chaos of the pieces, it completely overloads the nervous system.
It's too much data all at once.
Exactly. The brain basically forces a shutdown or a meltdown, or it triggers that primal instinct to elope, to just run away from whatever the stimulus is.
Or run away from the noise, yeah. But the text mentions the opposite end of the spectrum is just as dangerous, right?
Oh, hyposensitivity is arguably more terrifying for a caregiver.
Why is that?
Because the child's nervous system is under-registering input. So they might touch a burning hot radiator and the pain signal simply doesn't register as a cue to pull their hand away.
Oh, wow. That is terrifying.
Or think about a fire alarm. It goes off, and to them, it might just blend into the ambient noise of the house.
So yelling something like stop, drop, and roll is useless.
Completely useless. Following a standard verbal instruction during a crisis requires a level of sensory integration they just might not have access to in that moment.
So a standard childproofing checklist just totally fails here. An autism safety plan has to act more like a custom-tailored suit.
That's the perfect analogy. It has to adapt to that specific child's sensory profile.
But to make that suit, the guide says you have to literally get down and take measurements from their perspective. This part blew my mind. the physical home assessment.
Yes. Caregivers are instructed to literally change their physical altitude.
Like actually crawling on the floor.
You get on your hands and knees and you crawl through the house. Because from 3 feet off the ground, the environment looks like an entirely different landscape.
And the guide points out that a child's emotional interpretation of that landscape is totally different too. Like,
yeah,
we look at a narrow gap under a fence and think, well, that's a hazard.
Right, but a child looks at it and thinks, that's an adventure.
Exactly. Slipping through a window feels fun to them.
And they are incredibly determined when they are motivated. The document notes that those flimsy interior door locks, they're often defeated simply by applying brute force.
They just push until it breaks.
Yeah, a determined child will push until the mechanism just gives way. And furthermore, their capacity for snooping is unmatched.
I read that. They find things adults assume are completely securely hidden.
Keys, medications, weapons. If it's in the house, they can likely find it.
And the guide lists some specific hiding spots that I honestly wouldn't immediately flag. Small closets behind heavy furniture and, terrifyingly, inside large machines like washers and dryers.
Yeah, the washer and dryer thing comes back to sensory needs.
How so?
Well, a washing machine is this enclosed, dark space that offers proprioceptive feedback.
Meaning like it's tight against their body.
Exactly. It's tight, which is physically calming, and the thick metal muffles all that overwhelming auditory input from the house. To an overwhelmed child, the dryer feels like a sanctuary.
Wait, okay, I have to push back on this a little bit, because this creates a massive dilemma.
Go for it.
If a child is actively seeking out small, enclosed spaces during a panic, does the secured house itself become a trap?
That's a really good question.
Because we normally think of securing a house by putting deadbolts high up, you know, keeping them out of the basement or the garage. But if you lock them out of the safe-feeling basement and they seek out the washing machine instead, how do caregivers balance securing hazards with not accidentally trapping a panicking child?
You've just identified the absolute core tension of environmental design for neurodivergence. You cannot simply lock away every hazard.
Because then the house is just a prison of closed doors.
Exactly. And navigating an obstacle course of closed doors actually increases their anxiety. So the solution is redirection.
Redirection.
Yes. You actively create a magnetic, safe alternative that is significantly more appealing to them than the washing machine. You design an autism sensory safety area.
So stopping the emergency before it starts by just giving them a way better place to go.
You give the nervous system a designated sanctuary. So when a caregiver spots the early signs of dysregulation, or even if the child recognizes the rising panic in themselves, there is a physical destination engineered specifically for decompression.
And the text gets incredibly specific about how to outfit this space. It's not just a quiet room. It's like soft lighting, bean bags, lava lamps, weighted blankets, fidget spinners, and pleasing scents.
Right. And notice how every single item on that list targets a different sensory pathway.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Like the weighted blanket provides deep pressure therapy that physically lowers cortisol levels and signals the brain to calm down.
And the lava lamp.
It provides predictable, slow visual input. The specific fabrics on the beanbag offer tactile soothing. You are literally giving their sensory system the exact fuel it needs to regulate itself.
That makes so much sense. And there is a procedural rule for this space that I found fascinating. It's not just an open room that anyone can walk into. The caregiver and the child actually have to establish a code word or a physical signal to enter it.
Yeah, that signal establishes a boundary. Giving the child control over their entry into the space builds immense trust.
It's almost like a contract, right?
It is. It's a nonverbal contract where the caregiver promises, this is your zone. I respect your need for isolation right now, and I will not intrude.
And just having that guaranteed safety reduces the initial panic response.
Exactly. Knowing the safe space is strictly theirs lowers the stakes of the meltdown.
Now, beyond just that physical room, the guide heavily emphasizes visual routines throughout the whole house. Because autistic children are often very strong visual learners, right?
Oh, absolutely. They process visuals much more efficiently than verbal instructions during stress.
So the guide suggests using these first-then boards, physical stop signs on doors, and AEC, which is augmentative and alternative communication devices, for kids who are minimally verbal.
Yeah, you can think of these visual tools as essentially an emotional user interface for the home.
So what does this all mean? Like an emotional UI?
Well, think about a really good computer UI. It removes the cognitive load for the user, right? You don't have to guess what button to click next because the design just makes it obvious.
Oh, I love that analogy, emotional UI. But let me ask you this. If a kid is melting down, like if their sensory system is totally overloading, are they really going to stand there and read a first then board? Isn't it a bit too late at that point?
That is exactly why the visual board is so necessary. See, spoken language requires incredibly complex auditory processing.
Which is the first thing to go.
Yes. During a meltdown, the brain shuts down non-essential functions and verbal comprehension just drops off a cliff.
So if a parent is standing there verbally saying, calm down, first we put on shoes, then we go to the sensory room.
The child just hears Charlie Brown teacher noise, wah, wah, wah. But a simple visual icon of shoes, an arrow, and a picture of a beanbag, that bypasses the auditory processing center entirely. It delivers the instruction directly to the visual cortex.
It structures the unstructured time, which the guide flags as a major trigger for anxiety in the first place. You're basically removing the terrifying question of what happens next.
Exactly. You give them a clear roadmap when their internal compass is just spinning out of control.
But, you know, even the best operating system crashes sometimes.
They do.
The most robust, emotional UI sometimes just isn't enough, and emergencies still happen. Which brings us back to that really scary statistic I mentioned at the very beginning of this deep dive, the wandering or elopement.
Yeah, the data AngelSense provides on this is truly harrowing. Approximately half of all people with autism will wander.
Half. That is staggering.
It is. And of those reported wandering events, 33% results in injury or fatality.
And a really specific type of fatality, right? 71% of those fatalities are caused by drowning.
Yes. Water is incredibly visually stimulating. It sparkles, it moves, and it often lacks the chaotic auditory input of, say, a busy street.
So they're drawn to it.
They are heavily drawn to it, often without the danger awareness to understand they can't swim, or without the physical coordination to save themselves once they fall in.
Which circles back to that 74% statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because 74% of wandering incidents begin in the family home, while the child is actively being supervised.
It's the most sobering fact in the whole document.
And I want to pause on this.
No.
Because when a neurodivergent child goes missing, society has this horrible habit of immediately blaming the quote-unquote inattentive parent.
Oh, the judgment is instant and brutal.
Right. There's this automatic assumption of negligence, like, oh, someone was just scrolling on their phone or watching TV. But this data completely destroys that myth. It proves that human supervision simply is not a match for a highly motivated child.
It really isn't. Human beings blink, they go to the bathroom, they turn around for 5 seconds to stir a pot on the stove.
And that's all it takes.
It takes less than 30 seconds for a determined child to slip out a door. The guide acknowledges this reality without any judgment, and it shifts the focus entirely to preparation.
But you have to prepare without triggering the child's anxiety, which sounds like a tightrope walk.
It is, because if you sit them down and say, hey, if you leave the house by yourself, you could drown in the pond, you don't make them safer. You just introduce a brand new paralyzing phobia.
Right, they'll just be terrified of the door.
Exactly. So you have to use a neutral, matter-of-fact tone. Absolutely no fear-mongering. The guide suggests calm drills and social stories.
Social stories, those are visual guides, right?
Yes, a visual guide that walks through a specific scenario step by step. You use them to practice things like 911 calls, teaching the child to state their name, their address, and the nature of the emergency.
Because the abstract concept of an emergency is just too hard to grasp without concrete rehearsal.
Exactly. You have to rehearse it when they are calm, so the script is there when they panic.
But the preparation also has to extend way beyond the immediate family, right? The guide suggests building out two concentric circles of a support network.
Yes, the inner circle, which is your family and close friends, and the second circle, which includes therapists, neighbors, and teachers.
And you don't just, like, give them a heads up that your kid might wander. You actually arm them with two highly specific documented protocols.
Right. You need it in writing. The first is the information plan.
What goes into that?
This is a distributed document that details the child's specific sensory triggers, what calms them down, the exact steps to respond if they are seen wandering, and all the emergency contacts.
So if a neighbor sees the child walking down the street alone, they shouldn't just guess how to approach them.
Exactly. They should already have the instruction manual. They know not to yell their name or grab their arm, which might make them run into traffic.
And the second protocol is the participatory plan. Which, honestly, this feels like a military operation in the best way possible.
It really is an active deployment strategy. When a child goes missing, the first 10 minutes are absolutely critical.
So the participatory plan lists the specific places the child is known to be drawn to.
Exactly. If they love trains, you assign neighbor A to immediately drive to the train tracks. If they love water, Uncle B goes straight to the local pond.
Oh, that's brilliant. You eliminate that paralyzing, what do I do, freeze response.
Everyone already has their assigned search grid. You just activate the network.
But again, because human supervision is fallible, and because the stakes are just so unimaginably high, parents have to enlist non-human assistance.
Technology is the ultimate bridge between vulnerability and safety here.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The guide outlines this layered tech ecosystem. It's not just, you know, throwing an AirTag in a backpack and hoping for the best.
No, AirTags are not built for this level of security.
They break it down into low, medium, and high tech. And I love that low tech doesn't mean ineffective. It means things like smart door locks with numerical codes, ID bracelets, and literally just placing a heavy object, like an ottoman, in front of an exit.
The heavy ottoman is such a brilliant low-tech solution because it directly addresses the cognitive impulse.
How so?
Well, a child doesn't always plan to elope over several hours. Sometimes it's a split-second impulse. To move a heavy ottoman requires actual physical exertion.
So it slows them down.
Yes.
Yeah.
That physical friction slows their momentum, and breaking the physical momentum often breaks the cognitive impulse loop.
It forces a pause.
Exactly. It forces a pause, which gives the caregiver those precious few seconds to intervene.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
From there, we move to medium tech, which brings in basic electronics,
mm-hmm.
battery-powered door alarms that chime when they're opened, window sensors, interior movement monitors.
And perimeter alarms that link directly to a parent's mobile phone.
So they create, like, invisible tripwires around the house.
Precisely. If the physical boundary is breached, the caregiver's phone alerts them instantly, closing that gap of human error we talked about earlier.
Then we reach the high-tech tier. The guide dives deep into the AngelSense GPS tracker from 2026. And I was genuinely marveling at what this hardware can actually do. It goes way beyond standard satellite tracking.
It has to. Standard GPS fails indoors. This system uses a mesh of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi for indoor coverage.
Which is vital, right? Because as we noted with the washing machine example, the child might not have even left the property.
Right. They might be hiding deep inside the house where a normal GPS signal just drops out completely.
It also features geofencing. So an invisible boundary is drawn around the school or the yard. And crossing it triggers an instant alert to the parent.
And the wearables are specifically designed so they can't be easily removed by the child.
Which is a huge issue with sensory sensitivities, right? They'll often strip off a standard watch or clothing tag because it feels scratchy or restrictive.
Exactly. But these are designed to be highly sensory friendly and they lock in place. They are even comfortable enough to be worn to bed to prevent nighttime wandering.
And the location pings are crucial too.
Oh, absolutely.
If you know the child is within a 30-foot radius, but they are hiding in a dense thicket of bushes, you can trigger the device to emit a loud sound.
Which turns a frantic visual search into an auditory one, cutting down the search time drastically.
But the absolute standout feature for me is the remotely activated speaker.
It fundamentally changes the nature of a search and rescue.
Right. The caregiver can basically open a two-way audio line to the device itself. Imagine a nonverbal child who is lost, overwhelmed by the noise of traffic, just completely panicked.
It's a nightmare scenario.
But with this, the parent can speak directly to them through the wearable. They can provide a familiar, soothing voice, talking them down from a meltdown, while simultaneously using the GPS coordinates to drive straight to their location.
You are projecting the safety of the caregiver directly into the child's ear, no matter where they are in the world. It's incredible.
It makes me think of designing a high-end museum security system, but completely inverted.
Inverted how?
Well, a museum uses layers of lasers and sensors and guards to keep thieves out. But this layered technology, the alarms, the geofencing, the GPS, it's designed with the deepest possible love to keep the most precious thing safely inside.
That's a beautiful way to look at it.
And the irony is, by building this incredibly robust high-tech security net, you are actually granting them the freedom to roam their own exhibits safely.
That inverted museum concept really captures the entire spirit of the 2026 AngelSense Guide.
It really ties it all together.
Every single layer of protection we've unpacked today, from crawling on the floor to find the hidden hazards, to the deep pressure of a weighted blanket, the visual clarity of a first-then board, all the way up to an AI-assisted two-way GPS tracker, none of it is about restriction.
Not at all.
It is entirely about giving the family the infrastructure to allow the child greater independence. When you build calm, predictable structure into the physical walls of the home, the ambient anxiety drops for everyone. The child feels understood, and the parents can finally, truly breathe.
Spending time with this guide, it just profoundly shifts how you view accessibility. You walk through a standard home after reading this, and you suddenly realize how much invisible labor goes into it.
The amount of mental energy is staggering.
Yeah, how much deep, empathetic thought goes into translating a world built for neurotypical people into a truly safe space for a neurodivergent mind. It's so much more than plugging outlets. You're actively redesigning reality to accommodate the way they process the universe.
It transforms the home from a place of potential hazards into an active participant in their well-being.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I want to leave you with a thought to mull over today. We started by discussing how standard environments are basically blunt instruments built for a very narrow definition of how people navigate the world. But if implementing predictable, sensory-aware, and visually structured designs drastically reduces anxiety and prevents emergencies inside the private home, how might we rethink the architecture of our public spaces?
That's the real frontier.
What if our schools, our parks, our grocery stores were designed with this same emotional UI? How much ambient panic could we eliminate if the broader world was built to anticipate and soothe rather than just react?